This is the Digital Factory Podcast. I'm John Bruner. The Digital Factory is all about the technologies that are transforming the way things are designed, prototyped, and made. And the Digital Factory is brought to you by Formlabs, which makes precise, accessible, reliable 3D printers for the desktop and the benchtop. That includes the Form 2 stereolithography printer. That's the best-selling SLA desktop printer out there. And the newly announced Fuse 1 selective laser sintering printer. Learn more about the Form 2 and the Fuse 1 and how they can transform your prototyping and production workflows by visiting formlabs.com. Manufacturing is good for cities, and as it turns out, cities are great for manufacturing. That's the topic of today's episode of the podcast. We're going to be talking about how cities can attract robust manufacturing ecosystems, and how entrepreneurs and people who are developing great products can take advantage of a rich, sophisticated manufacturing city. My guest today is Christina Holly, known to most as Z Holly. She's the founder of Make It in LA and the host of The Art of Manufacturing. Z, it's great to have you on.
Great to be here. Thanks, John.
Now, you work on a lot of interesting areas. In particular, you're an authority on the way that manufacturing can fit into urban economies, and you've done a lot to help develop the manufacturing sector in Los Angeles, and you've followed a lot of really interesting entrepreneurial stories in the LA area as well. So I wonder if you could just begin by telling us sort of what drew you to this area, what drew you to manufacturing, and in particular, manufacturing in Los Angeles.
Yeah, you know, I think that the key thing is how amazingly complex the existing manufacturing ecosystem is in LA. Most people don't realize that LA is the largest manufacturing center in the country. Most people think that LA is just about Hollywood. But if you look at for every job in film and television, there's four jobs in manufacturing in LA. So it's a huge part of the sector. So what I realized as I have a tech background, and I've been an entrepreneur and have developed innovation centers at two different universities and have recognized this real power of supporting entrepreneurs and entrepreneurial leaders and connecting the community, and realizing that that piece was missing in the manufacturing sector. So as big as it was, and my hope was to try to figure out how do we support that sector, it was really hard to find my way around. And part of that was because it's not as well connected and doesn't have that sense of community as it does in sort of tech or Hollywood does.
What's kind of the core of the manufacturing sector in LA? I know that there's a big aerospace industry there, but is a lot of the manufacturing these days related to the entertainment industry?
It's really broad, and that's actually a huge strength of LA, but also makes it harder to focus. Mm-hmm, you know, mm-hmm. We don't have one industry, and so definitely aerospace is huge, and food, especially given that we're kind of California's like the breadbasket of the country, fashion, huge. It's really the center for apparel manufacturing in the country, and we all industrial transportation. You mm-hmm. know, that's why Hyperloop, both of the Hyperloops, actually started in LA. Automotive, that's where almost all of the designers of today's cars are based in LA. There's actually quite a bit of electronics manufacturing as well, and it's a huge port for trade. So if you think about all of the trade that comes in and out of the ports of the country, close to half, like 46% or so, come through the port of Los Angeles. So it's also a really big logistical hub for the country.
Is there any respect in which you see the entertainment industry sort of cross-pollinating with manufacturing? You mentioned the designers for the automotive industry there. Is there any common sort of, you know, DNA?
Well, a lot of different aspects to that, actually. So I would say one of them is this really amazing sort of talent base of fabricators and inventors that come from Hollywood. So you think about special effects, robotics, set design, costume design. These are things that have to be created short-term basis. The negative of that is that a lot of the creatives are not necessarily versed or maybe even interested sometimes in creating something that scales through manufacturing. So that's a real opportunity to tap. Another aspect is just the whole sort of style, celebrity, culture, and just being kind of this creative center. There's this real opportunity to use influencers and sort of brands. It's a real center for where brands can get a start. And so a lot of consumer goods, fashion, et cetera, are based increasingly in LA. And so you have companies like Iconery, for example. I had Yves Adam, the CEO, on my podcast, and she's doing something really interesting where she's tapping into this manufacturing base for jewelry, which is really complicated. It's a very complicated industry, very, you know, fractured, and for someone really hard to break in. And she's working with influencers to help them develop jewelry lines, 3D print the molds, and then get the jewelry done. And then they have an e-commerce portal to sell that jewelry. So e-commerce actually and advertising really is a huge part of our tech economy here in Los Angeles as well. So all of those things really interplay.
So it sounds like you've got sort of the whole stack, right? It makes it a lot easier to go out and source things if you've got an idea for a new business or a new type of thing that you want to make, perhaps compared to some cities that are monolithically devoted to a single industry.
Yeah, and it's a mixed blessing because it makes it much more complicated. I think it's a lot easier when you have one industry and a supply chain for one industry in a particular region. It's much easier for everyone to know each other and to really understand the customer requirements. And so I think that that's where the opportunity is and also the challenge.
In your organizing work, have you been able to find commonalities between, say, aerospace companies and jewelry manufacturers in seeing their common interests and getting them to work together as part of a community?
Well, I think that part of the opportunities are through technology. So I think that, for example, additive manufacturing is something that really cross cuts. So, you know, like as an Iconery, you know, it's a one way to create the jewelry molds and the dyes are using 3D printing. And of course, 3D printing is incredibly important in aerospace as well. Mm-hmm. There's not a lot of cross-pollination yet. And I think that the cultures are very different, which I find fascinating because that's actually, if I look back on my career, that's something that I've really enjoyed doing. I've created these innovation centers at universities, for example, that were crossing the boundaries between academia and the business community. And those are two mm-hmm. very different cultures. And I think that that's a very, there's a similarity also between the designers, the makers, the entrepreneurs, I use the word makers really broadly, mm-hmm. but bridging the divide between people who really understand branding with mm-hmm. a manufacturing, you know, a factory that is really just about efficiency and trying to get the product produced. And it's a huge cultural divide. And it's exciting to see some of the factories really getting excited about the branding and mm-hmm. the technology and adopting some of these technologies.
We live in this fun age when, you know, the tactile experience of manufacturing or the visual experience of manufacturing seems like it's more available than ever before. You can go on YouTube and watch videos of pretty much anything being manufactured. And a lot of these videos have millions of views. I mean, I went recently and looked at the How It's Made archive on YouTube, and one of the top most viewed videos is about how shredded onions are made and packaged. You know, so people will watch any of these processes, and that's not even a high tech process, but you can engage people with, you know, engage ordinary consumers as well as engineers who love watching these things as well by just pointing out sort of how things are done and giving them some insight into the technology behind the process.
And there is a great hope, I think, the fact that, I don't know, I love to say that manufacturing is sexy mm-hmm. and it's fun to watch, to roll up your sleeves, to actually make stuff. And at the same time, unfortunately, a lot of folks, although they think that manufacturing, there's a Gallup study, actually, they did a survey a couple months ago that showed that by far, Americans think that the most important thing we can do to grow employment in the country is to support manufacturing. Mm. However, this was not in the Gallup poll, but other surveys have shown that people don't want their kids. They don't want to be in manufacturing. They don't want their kids to be in manufacturing, not realizing that there actually is a huge future in manufacturing. And there's this crazy meme saying that, well, we've lost it. It's gone. It's a dead end industry. And I really would love, I mean, that's one of the things that I like to do with my podcast is to inspire folks to realize that, wow, there's a lot of opportunity in making stuff, and you can make it locally. And that's what my nonprofit's about. We created Make It in LA, which helps connect the community here in LA. And I think local manufacturing has a lot of advantages. And in particular, LA, you know, has a lot of potential. And so we'd love to tap into that potential.
Yeah, that strikes me as a really big sort of gap in understanding or misunderstanding among the public about what kinds of jobs exist in manufacturing and can exist in manufacturing. When you look at it collectively as just manufacturing, it can seem sort of bleak. And I think a lot of people agree that the days of, you know, 15,000 employees marching into a steel mill in the morning with their lunchboxes and hard hats may be over in a lot of places. But one level up from those, the skilled machine shop operators, the CNC technicians, the automation-oriented sort of workers, a lot of jobs that aren't desk jobs, but that are kind of like high-skilled manufacturing floor jobs. Manufacturers can't fill these positions. They're desperate to hire.
It's crazy. It's crazy. I saw a study or an article about recently about Connecticut and how they had thousands of jobs that are open right now and they couldn't fill them in manufacturing. And that's a tiny state, you know? They couldn't fill them because lack of skill and also unemployability. People didn't know how to show up to work on time. They were failing drug tests. I mean, just simple stuff like that. It's crazy.
Yeah. I flew into Cleveland recently to go to a conference there. And, you know, in San Francisco, the airport is full of these posters that are like, launch your career in engineering SaaS database products at this company. Like, go to this URL and get a job. And in Cleveland, the airport was also full of like launch your career posters, and they were all heavy industry and manufacturing. It was like, you know, launch your career at Northeast Ohio's premier manufacturer of specialized coatings and finishing abrasives. And it was just, you know, these ads all over the place. So these companies that are doing heavy, important kinds of manufacturing are just desperate for people to fill these jobs. And they are good jobs. I mean, they're pretty stable. They're very clear paths for advancement if you do well in them. And we tend to think of the Rust Belt as just hemorrhaging these jobs, but all it takes is a walk through Cleveland's airport to see that that industry is really robust and is looking to hire people.
Mm. I think we're preaching to the choir here. What do you think?
Yeah, I think so.
How do we get it? How do we get the word? Like, that's the question. How do we get the word out? So that's what we're trying to do, right?
Yeah. Well, and there are plenty of jobs that are, you know, digital manufacturing crossovers, and that industries that people think of as very healthy, you can kind of go into those. You can study software. You can study industrial design, other kinds of design and engineering, and wind up focusing on manufacturing, which is what a lot of people who have crossed over from kind of the Bay Area tech industry into hardware have done. I think a lot of them have software backgrounds and they've seen the light in hardware.
Well, and I think that there's a similar opportunity with folks that really understand creatives or folks that understand branding, that's a real opportunity as well. And I think that there's a lot of focus on automation as a quote unquote job killer. I mean, we can go down that path, but I'm sure you've already discussed it and, you know, how it creates opportunities too, but, you know, all that. But I think that one of the things that was a real light bulb for me, so I was chatting with Nick Pinkston from Plethora from the Bay Area on my podcast. And we were talking a lot about the future of work and automation, et cetera. And something that occurred to me was we don't talk about the tools. So automation makes rote things, you know, easier to do and kind of remove some of the manual labor out of it. But there's other tools that you may or may not call it automation. Maybe there's an AI component to it that enable creatives who don't know anything about manufacturing or engineering to actually be designing new products. So it creates more opportunities for the different folks that do not have those skills to actually be producing. And so I actually think that it doesn't just eliminate unskilled jobs. It's actually enabling people to cross over when they don't have the skills.
Yeah. And jewelry, which you mentioned a second ago, is a great example because that field is getting much more digital. A lot of artisans will now design the piece they want to make in 3D modeling software and then print it using a burnout resin or jeweler's wax, essentially, and then use that to actually cast the piece that they want to make. And in the process, a lot of, you know, geometries and a lot of styles that might only have been accessible to larger, you know, well-capitalized manufacturers are now accessible to individual artists. So this digitization is widening the envelope of possibilities for people who want to create jewelry.
Yeah, that said, I also have to say that I'm an analog kind of person, and maybe it's just me, but I really miss the blue foam with a hot wire, making models, you know, having been a mechanical engineer and like creating these product mock-ups using that sort of more of these analog tools. I think that there's something very tactile that's missing. And so that's where I feel like there's a huge opportunity in digital fabrication, digital manufacturing, are those front-end tools. So despite the fact that they're getting better and they're creating more opportunities, I don't think we're even close yet. And I think that that's the biggest gap. I was a beta tester for a 3D printing company, and I won't mention who it is, but The front end tools were so bad that it almost became a doorstop, you know, because mm-hmm. it just was really hard to use it. And so I think that's one of the reasons why on the consumer side, sort of the desktop manufacturing is still suffering a bit, but that creates a great opportunity.
Yeah. Solid modeling and CAD remain their own kind of technical language. And it takes a particular mindset, you know, to go through the parametric design process and turn 2D sketches into extruded shapes that sort of intersect with each other and get to the thing that you want. So, and speaking of your background in hardcore engineering, you have a couple of degrees in mechanical engineering from MIT, and your first job was in aerospace, in working on space shuttle engines in LA. And I wonder if you ever reflect on kind of that end of the hardware and manufacturing business, which is probably like the most exacting kind of manufacturing and engineering that you can have, and compare it to the modern landscape of what like a startup is able to accomplish now. Does it feel like small teams of people are able to do really serious engineering work and do stuff that they haven't been able to do before? Or does it feel like these are really two separate communities?
Well, I think that things have been changing significantly. And you just look at companies like SpaceX, for example, mm-hmm. And what they can accomplish, applying a lot of those entrepreneurial leadership and management principles. And it's not going to be the same. You know, it's not, the iteration process is a lot harder the bigger you get. But there are ways of creating minimal viable products mm-hmm. that don't involve building the entire system out. And my experience when I was working on the space shuttle main engine was the incredible inertia to change. It was really challenging. There was it was so long ago that I will probably get some of these details wrong, but I do remember there's something like 46,000 feet of cooling tubing on the engine. And so I was working on the systems that were welding the tubing. So I worked on a very small part of it. I created this calibration fixture for mm-hmm. the welding and then creating this other welding system. But there was a particular engineer in our advanced manufacturing team who had this really out there idea of a new technology. It was really unproven that they wanted to apply, because one mistake mm-hmm. and, you know, on 46,000 feet, and that's $1 million+ engine, you know, you're talking about. And there was a huge amount of inertia against those kinds of changes. And so I think that that's where a lot of this is. Lean startup methodology, mm-hmm. I'm kind of laughing by saying lean startup methodology applied to manufacturing. Actually, it came from lean manufacturing. So the iterative process. So we often forget that some of that, the startup methodology actually is based in the Toyota method.
Right. From the heaviest possible kind of manufacturing.
Yes. But, you know, another great example is, so there's a company called Divergent 3D. I interviewed the CEO, Kevin Zinger, and he's super fascinating. I think you know him. And he is creating this new car company that's based on designing cars using these 3D printed nodes and carbon fiber links. And you can really optimize the design of these cars to make them super lightweight and crash resistant. And in fact, the platform that he's creating, he's partnering with other companies, enables them to design and get a car into production within 2 years as opposed to 7 years. And they can actually, because of the low capital expenditure, you can actually be profitable after only making 10,000 cars. That's unheard of, which means that not only is it very efficient and quick, but you can innovate really quickly. And so it does enable you to iterate very quickly. And it's much more sustainable because it uses much less resources.
Right. So it becomes practical to actually sort of do an innovation ramp, where with conventional auto manufacturing, that's totally impractical. You spend tens or hundreds of millions of dollars on retooling a factory, you implement the entire thing, and everything has to be completely right before you churn out your first like 100,000 cars.
And that's why you get all this inertia against new ideas like electric vehicles or autonomous vehicles from the existing companies, because you have that, mm-hmm. you have the legacy
and the
slower innovation cycles, but that doesn't have to be the case anymore.
Yeah, you know, I've spoken with a lot of people about the idea of the digital factory and how digitization can reduce risk, because there's less pressure to lock in a design at the outset and then commit to using that design over like millions of products. And a lot of people understand this inherently. And if you're talking about a startup that might want to, you know, have a flexible design and try things out, but they're a little surprised to consider that this is really meaningful to a giant company that faces enormous risk when they lock in like a auto design or an iPhone design and send it off to the factory.
Yeah, and I think that there's this tension, this fundamental tension between efficiency and resilience, you know, mm-hmm. and flexibility. And second law of thermodynamics probably says that as well, you know, like you can't really have both. But I think that with digital fabrication, it does let you get rid of a lot of the waste in the system.
Yeah, there, you mentioned SpaceX. And of course, there's also, you know, Tesla, for instance, that came in and designed a completely new car from scratch that's radically different from mm-hmm. anything that the older automakers have managed to do. There's some advantage to just beginning from something new. You don't have so much to lose. And that's a huge thing that, I think a lot yep. of people overlook. If you're General Motors, you can't produce a new car that could bring the entire company down. It's a different thing for General Motors than it is for Tesla in its first 3 years. But sometimes it takes that new company to come in and try something really radical.
Well, let's hope that they can all coexist and be competitive and bring us consumers great things.
Exactly, exactly. So I'd love to go back to your thoughts on cities. Manufacturing is, as you mentioned earlier, the object of a lot of interest from city leaders, from economic development types. What advice do you have for cities that are looking to create a vibrant manufacturing community?
I think it depends on the city. And the most important thing is to look at what your innate skills and competitive advantage is. So don't try to be a city that you're not. Mm-hmm. Second of all is to really consider manufacturing as a really important inclusive source of employment for the city and diversification of jobs in the city, and also the fact that it provides jobs for it. When I say diversity, there's also diversity from the standpoint of the folks that it engages. It mm-hmm. creates you know, a wide range of types of jobs for a lot of different people with different backgrounds. And in fact, it's sort of, as a side note, with Make It in LA, we had this call for entrepreneurs to apply for this pilot factory tour workshops that we're doing. We had almost 100 applicants, and 67% of them were women and minority-owned businesses, which is really cool. And it's very different. It kind of flies in the face of the stereotype of what an entrepreneur is. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So I think that there's a lot of opportunity there. And then there's, in large cities like LA, San Francisco, New York, there's a lot of tension between industrial land and land for housing, especially when housing is in such short supply. So just really considering jobs and manufacturing as a source is another approach to affordability. Mm-hmm. So clearly you need to have housing in order for housing to be affordable. We just have this huge shortage in LA. And at the same time, creating good jobs makes that housing more affordable. Mm-hmm. So just having a balanced approach, I think, is really important. And then finally, looking at the entrepreneurs, how to connect the ecosystem, and entrepreneurs being one of the components. When I say entrepreneurs, I mean both makers and also entrepreneurial leaders of companies that want to grow and scale and figure out how to more effectively make those connections happen.
I think it makes sense to take a much more holistic approach to this and recognize what kinds of people can participate in manufacturing. There's a lot of sort of smokestack chasing is what it's called, right? When cities, you know, lose like the big paper plant that used to be in the town, and then they kind of go and offer tax breaks to anyone who can come in and do some sort of manufacturing to replace those jobs without really thinking about who does it.
Yeah, it's a race to the bottom.
Exactly. So, Z, on your podcast, the Art of Manufacturing, you talk with a lot of entrepreneurs who have gotten into making some kind of product, and you always ask them about their entrepreneurial journey, how they came along on this process. What have you learned? What can you generalize about the entrepreneurial journey in manufacturing from all of these people that you've spoken with?
I think there's some surprises in some ways. One of the surprises was how mission-driven a lot of these entrepreneurs are. Mm-hmm. So even for some of the more prosaic things, but I've had a couple of entrepreneurs that specifically started their business to hire people that are coming back from prison, for example. Mm. And that was the big core part of their mission. I have, for example, Eric Alistad from Local Roots, who is rethinking the supply chain for produce and creating these urban farms inside shipping containers. It's 5 acres of farmland in one shipping container. It's crazy. But he's really thinking about rethinking how we move produce around and how bad that is for the environment. And so there's so many stories like that of folks that just really want to make the world a better place. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And that's exciting. And I think also just the sense of determination and what these entrepreneurs go through. I think a lot of folks, they romanticize entrepreneurship because you hear about the success stories after the fact.
Right.
And I mean, having been an entrepreneur myself, I know what that roller coaster is like, and I still live it, you know. But we have folks like Carl Kanai, who's like the original creator of the urban streetwear, kind of urban streetwear back in the late 80s. And he almost lost the rights to his name. And he had to buy it back. It cost him something like $10 million over 8 years to get the rights back. We had someone who had gone, her company went bankrupt because of a bad business deal. They developed the Flyknit shoe for Nike, actually. But unfortunately, things didn't work out quite so well. And you just hear these stories about how just the absolute depths of despair sometimes that people go through. And so it's not for everyone. Mm-hmm. And I think that's really important for people to know. But I think that it's still inspiring to hear those stories. And sometimes, you know, when you know what you're... Sometimes I think that it's better to not know how hard it's going to be and be in that crazy data denial.
Well, and how prosaic it is as well, right? I mean, the good entrepreneurs, the successful entrepreneurs are the ones who had a really awesome vision and a really glorious idea, but who also executed and stayed up late and sent the emails and, you know, wrote the careful contracts with partners and hired the right people to carry it out.
Absolutely. I mean, you hear the crazy story of, I had one, Jessie Janae. She actually went on Shark Tank. She had started a company, her own manufacturing company, age 16. And she went on Shark Tank. She turned Mark Cuban down. Then she realized, as a result of the challenges she had with her business, that's where she created a whole new company that is a platform for entrepreneurs, manufacturing entrepreneurs, to be able to deal with all of their packaging. And it sounds, like you said, it sounds very prosaic, like packaging, you know. But if you think about all of these direct-to-consumer businesses, that is the first interaction their customer has with their brand. Mm-hmm. And most companies don't think about packaging. And part of it is it's really hard to think about packaging. So those are some of the stories. But I think just the diversity and the mission driven aspect of what they're doing is really pretty cool.
I'd like to move on now to our new and soon to be recurring segment called Tools. This is where I ask our guests to meditate on their favorite tools. Could be anything from, you know, Microsoft Excel over to some sort of gorgeous Swiss calipers that are sitting in your toolbox. So, Z, tell us about your favorite tool.
Oh my God, does it have to be manufacturing related?
No, it doesn't. It could be, yeah.
The one that jumps to mind right now is I've really been getting into rock climbing last year. And so my belay device is the most amazing thing that enables me to climb, to belay, to keep someone from killing themselves. I don't think that that's what you're looking for. But it's such a simple device. It's there's different kinds. So one of them is a Gree-Gree, which, so I have two different kinds. One is a Gree-Gree, which is an auto braking device. So it helps slow, and it has these cams in it. And so the rope goes through, and you always hold your hand on the rope below it. And that just is sort of the backstop. But if somebody falls, it pulls up on the cam and then it helps auto brake. You're still supposed to hold on.
Huh.
And that's pretty cool. And then when you let them down, or if they're leading, which is, I mean, if you're not into climbing, it's extra complexity, but you're playing out the rope. And so then you have to actually hold the cam down. So that's a more complex system. It's heavier. You might not want to use it, you know, kind of in the backcountry. It's a little bit harder to use sometimes. And then the simpler device is the called an ATC. It's just two holes and held onto you have a carabiner on your harness. Mm-hmm. And if you're just belaying, you just have a loop of rope that goes through the hole and goes through your carabiner. And if somebody falls, then it pulls that device towards your carabiner and it locks the rope. And then you just kind of play it out if the person's leading or if you need to lower them down. There's a little bit of an extra, and the one that I have has a little extra kind of a friction device down the bottom. So if you really hold it down, it'll slow it down more. And so it's so simple. And it's just, you know, there's been a whole history of different kinds of belay devices and rappelling devices that people have used. But this particular one has stood the test of time and is kind of the gold standard for the non-fancy, non-auto braking ones.
Right. That's really cool. The kind of innovation that goes into a purely mechanical device like that is really fun. For those of us who live in a kind of, you know, hybrid electromechanical world where a lot of the innovation happens in software, it's always really fun to consider things like this that are just a really ingenious mechanical design.
And less to break, right? When it's
right.
just
right. There's no batteries to run out.
Oh my, could you imagine if it was as reliable as my phone? Like, oh my God, I'd probably die half the time.
Right, reboot your belay device.
Rebooting.
Awesome. So, Z, it's been wonderful talking with you today. If listeners want to continue and find you online, where should they look?
So if you want to hear the podcast, you can look on your favorite podcast player for The Art of Manufacturing, or mm-hmm. you could go to artofmfg.com. And if you're in LA and want to get invited to events or learn about what's going on, then you can go to makeitinla.org or check on Twitter and Instagram at WeMakeItInLA. We also have actually a Facebook group that's Art of MFG.
Excellent. My guest is Christina Holly. Z, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks so much. It was great to be on.
The Digital Factory podcast is brought to you by Form Labs. The Form 2 is the best-selling desktop stereolithography 3D printer. It enables anyone to create intricate designs and functional prototypes in a wide variety of materials right from their desk. The new Fuse 1 is a benchtop selective laser sintering 3D printer that makes robust parts out of nylon with efficient part packing and total geometric freedom. Learn about both the Form 2 and the Fuse 1 at formlabs.com. With the Digital Factory, I'm John Bruner.